This is WGTD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show is hosted by Felicia King of Quality Plus Consulting and airs the first and third Saturdays of every month.
Good morning. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, and I'm Felicia King. Today's show is going to be part two of Verizon's 2017 data breach report, which covered their prior 12 months of risk analysis, their risk team's activities, and the correlative data from that. So it really encompasses what they learned as special stuff from the 2016 activities. So let's get started. Where we left off was on scenario 5, and I'm going to post my version of the marked up version of their Verizon data breach report so that you can download it and read it, because I've got quite a lot of interesting notes on it. So scenario 5 is partner misuse. Now, you may remember that this actually categorizes quite a lot of like the target breach. The target breach was about their HVAC contractor having very poor security standards, but of course at the same time, Target also left them a giant big gaping hole to drive through. So on this particular one that's talking about partner misuse, I think this is especially relevant to all these organizations out there that hire, you know, they hire some trusted partner. So as an example, you're hiring somebody to do your point of sale system for your retail establishment. Maybe you have a chain of gas stations. Okay, maybe you got a chain of gas stations and you hire an organization to do all the POS systems. Well, the question that you have to ask is, do they actually know what they're doing? And I think, like any industry, there is a tremendous amount of variance that exists out there between people who are providing POS systems. I've seen some of the most ragingly incompetent stuff ever done. And yet at the same time, I know of some very large companies that do a phenomenal job of protecting POS systems. So, you know, the option is out there, but have you vetted your partner thoroughly to find out whether or not they secure the POS systems? So in this particular case, Verizon was talking about a chain of gas stations where all of their POS systems were actually directly ingress accessible over the internet. This really reminded me of the recent printer breach that happened where the gray hat hacker guy had found all of these POS printers that were on the internet, and he sent them print jobs, you know, to basically tell the people that owned these POS printers, hey, your printer is wide open to the internet. You might want to do something about that. And I remember my analysis of that at the time was I was really shocked at the percentage, the very significant percentage of all of the internet accessible printers that he found on the internet at that time were POS printers as opposed to, you know, other types of printers. So I would say if you have a POS system because you're in some sort of a retail setting, you should really take a keen eye on questioning the security of that thing or not. All right, so, you know, really the only way to fix this particular breach by a vendor is just to hire a competent vendor. Because it can be very difficult for you to have your own IT security people be effective in working with a POS vendor. And I've literally been in this scenario many times where, I mean, I'm a security architect. I know what I'm doing, but then I have to deal with a POS vendor who just clearly does not have even one person on staff at any level in any of their engineering teams throughout their entire quite sizable organization that has any clue or desire to have a clue about security. So their entire platform does goofy stuff. And their entire platform is set up in such a way that it does not facilitate running in any sort of secure mode. So if it is then your job to make this horribly designed system actually work, well, inherently, there is a limit to what you can do to keep it secure. So really, as the business owner, you need to ensure that the POS vendor that you're selecting actually knows what they're doing. And I'll throw one other very useful tidbit out there for you, which is that just because they say they're PCI compliant, it doesn't mean a hill of beans, a very tiny little hill of beans. It means nothing. Every single time I have seen one of these incompetent vendors claim that they have PCI compliance, they don't. It's a complete blazing, raging lie, and ultimately it's you, the business owner, who has the liability. You, as the business owner, are going to be the person who has to certify that your systems are PCI compliant every single year. But again, if the vendor has created their systems in such a way that inherently they can't be PCI compliant, it's still your liability. So just realize that they all lie. And I mean, I hate to be so dramatic about it, but it seems to be ubiquitous. I mean, it really just seems to be ubiquitous. I mean, I've seen so many retail style POS systems where when I challenge them about the PCI compliance, I'm like, well, okay, we just had a conversation about how your system works, but if I look here at the PCI compliance standards, it says this, this, and this. Well, you just told me that your stuff can't allow that, or it doesn't work that way. Then how can this system ever be PCI compliant? Oh, and then they just get angry. So I think the other lesson to take away from that is that if you are a business owner and you're trying to vet point of sale system vendors, then get somebody like me involved to assist you in that vetting process, because it's way more expensive to have a breach or a compliance violation on the back end than to just do a more extensive vetting process and just not do business with bad POS vendors from the get-go. So I'm gonna move on to the next one. The next scenario was a USB infection, and from my perspective, this is such old hat news, it's beyond all levels of comprehension for me that people are still falling prey to this. Because, yeah, I agree that it can be difficult to implement policies that completely break down USB functionality, because you can't do that while still keeping a keyboard and mouse working. What you can do is use endpoint protection to prevent USB connected things from auto running. You can train your staff to just not use USB anything, no USB flash drives, no USB hard drives, nothing like that. You can put an HR policy in place that tells them to never connect these things. And then you can put endpoint protection on the systems that, of course, scans for ransomware, malware of any sort of variety, does behavioral analytics and like script blocking types of things. You can do all of that, and that's standard operating procedure. You can have your people not run as administrators on their workstations. And so there's so many ways to mitigate this risk of USB breaching, and there's so much to be gained from doing it. I mean, nothing good comes from taking your flash drive and putting it into a system that you don't know its entire history. Nothing good comes from that. And there's also nothing good that comes from you being given a flash drive from somebody that you do not have a comprehensive knowledge of the entire history of that, and I'm talking from a security architect perspective, right? And then you take that and put that into your computer. I mean, there isn't enough money you could give me to the point where you could hand me a USB flash drive and I'd stick it in my computer. I mean, it's just not going to happen. In fact, I remember sitting in a security conference last year, and I was dumbfounded by, I was sitting in this conference with, you know, 50, 60 security professionals, and there was this flash drive going around the room that was supposedly had, you know, the presentation content on it. And I kept saying, well, isn't this presentation content going to be uploaded to one of the websites where we can grab it and download it from there? Because I know that if I get that content over a network channel, then I can scan it and make sure that that stuff isn't going to infect my systems. On the other hand, there is insanity associated with taking an unknown USB flash drive, especially a USB flash drive that has just been handed around and inserted in like 40 computers, and then stick that into your own computer. I can't even put a metric on how insane that is. But yet I was the only security professional sitting in that entire room who was like, no, get that USB flash drive away from me. I am not touching that thing. Just shocked. And so as a business owner, you also should be aware that your IT staff needs to be that vigilant. You know, they need to have a policy, since their account inherently has more access to things than they should know. Well, definitely, we have to have a policy that says, you know, the IT people are not going to be doing stuff with USB flash drives. They need to then use their brain cells to come up with different techniques to use network-based mechanisms to do file transfers. And you know what? I have yet to come up with a circumstance where I actually had to have a USB flash drive where I couldn't do a network-based file transfer, except in an extremely rare circumstance where it was in a highly controlled environment, and in that highly controlled environment, I could use a known quantity USB flash drive that I knew its entire history. Okay. So there's just nothing good comes from sharing flash drives. Now, one of the things that did bother me about this particular segment of the Verizon data breach report is that they were using terminology such as antivirus. And I have to say that antivirus as a strategy is a dead strategy. It's been a dead strategy for quite some time. And the reason it's a dead strategy is because antivirus is a signature-based detection technique. It is not a behavioral-based detection technique. So from a behavioral-based stuff, that is not a dead technique. You know, what you need now is endpoint protection. You need a host-based security product, which needs to have 80% more functionality than what is antivirus. Does it do antivirus? Sure it does. But it also does 80% or 90% more than what just antivirus ever did. So I hate using this term antivirus because it's so horrifically misleading. You know, you can't think about endpoint security and endpoint protection anymore at all from this terminology of antivirus, because it's signature-based detection, which is just a dead strategy. The game that you have to play now is behavioral-based detection. All right, so the next scenario is about peripheral tampering. And this peripheral tampering, I didn't really find it that interesting. It wasn't really applicable to the majority of people, but it's something that you should be aware of, at least as a consumer, from the perspective of knowing that it happens quite often to ATM machines, gas station credit card readers, or credit card readers or debit card readers that are at grocery stores or retail establishments, right? But so that they use this terminology, the Verizon team uses this terminology of peripheral tampering. And if you look at Krebs on Security website, so Brian Krebs' website, he has probably done the most exhaustive long-term study of point of sale tampering and card skimmers and stuff like that. And if you really want to know about that, I strongly suggest you go to KrebsOnSecurity.com and take a look at what he's published about it, because he's got a ton of photographs. And as a consumer, the more photographs you can see about device tampering from a, you know, credit card or debit card information theft perspective, then you as a consumer can look at your ATM machine and go, that's not quite right. I'm not going to use that ATM machine, right? All right. So the next scenario is the hacktivist attack. And much of this is about SCADA platform devices. And these devices are typically used in the industrial controls area. And, you know, I'm not really going to talk much about this other than to simply say that one of the things that I find rather disturbing is that the utilities throughout the United States, you know, whether we're talking about, you know, water, sewer, power, pipelines in general, just whatever those utilities are, they are too much of the time still utilizing ancient technology that has not been protected. And that's concerning because that leaves our nation's infrastructure more open to attack. And you can imagine that if the electrical grid on a widespread basis went down in the entire Midwest, people would start to die probably right away. I mean, there's a limit as to how long a hospital can go without electricity. I remember a particularly hot summer where elderly in Chicago died simply because they didn't have electricity, and it was a, you know, they experienced like heat stroke and died. And so people are going to die when there are extended periods of time when those utilities are not available. So what can we do? Well, we can, you know, basically recommend that our utilities, or that, you know, government steps in and says, hey, utilities, you need to actually secure your systems, or that maybe an industry association like IEEE would get together and write standards. Although I have to say, I think that the NIST SP800 set already includes cybersecurity controls for SCADA systems. So it's probably really an enforcement issue at this point in time. All right, so moving on to the next one is rogue detection. And so this has to do with rogue stuff on your network or on your devices. And I really enjoyed this particular one because I've talked about this exact thing with many people over the years, where they will be arguing with me about, like, well, why do I need to secure the guest network on our business environment? Why do I need to filter that traffic, etc.? You know, and the thing I always say to them is, well, it's your IP address, it's your IP space, it's your internet service provider connection. If the Fed or the ISP or any other power party is determining that malicious garbage is coming from your IP space, they will just shut down your connection. Or they could start blacklisting your IP addresses. Now, if they do that, if the IP addresses associated with your legitimate business activity ends up in a blacklist, especially like a botnet site list, then your day-to-day business functions are probably going to cease. And this comes down to the fact that other organizations are using security controls in place that are going to block known sources of malicious garbage. So if you've allowed malicious garbage to be exfiltrating your network that is assigned to you, that is your problem, and it will have an adverse impact on your business. And by the way, the same thing applies to your home network too. There have been many cases of people going to jail for stuff that initiated or was propagated from their network that they didn't actually do because somebody co-opted their network. So you do need to be concerned about what's happening on the guest network. You cannot just do some free-for-all. And, of course, that's what Verizon recommended to these people that had their business shut down because the ISP shut them down, and then they ended up getting their IP space on botnet blacklist. And, in fact, recently I had a newer client discover that their former IT guy had never gone through the effort of getting their IP addresses off of an email blacklist, like a spam blacklist. And so as a result, they were having a tremendous problem with email deliverability on an outbound basis. There was just all kinds of things that were dumping those connections. So what we ended up having to do was to use an outbound smart host in order to get around that. So this sort of thing where you get on a blacklist, your IP addresses are on a blacklist, it can be very, very time consuming and highly expensive to get off of that blacklist. So you need to be very serious about, you know, being a responsible internet user. And if you happen to be the IT staff who's in charge of what's coming from your network, you need to be serious about ensuring that the bad guys are not able to use devices on the trusted or your guest network or anything in between to then hack external parties or to just become a nuisance in general. All right, the next scenario is about a logic switch. Now, this has to do with SQL injection leading to stolen credentials, command and control backdoor implementations, and privilege abuse. So this one's a little more sophisticated, so I'm going to kind of breeze over it because I think it has limited applicability in what we can mitigate ourselves, unless you happen to be the IT management for a bank. And what this comes down to is a bank administrator was a disgruntled employee. You know, they were a highly privileged user and had known about the internal controls weaknesses that existed in the internal controls of that bank's systems and exploited that to, of course, their own financial benefit by having a whole lot of unauthorized financial transactions that financially benefited the bad guy. And ultimately, the way to have prevented that was to have better controls in place. And when I'm talking controls, some of the things that the Verizon team recommended was to put in a process to detect changes to encryption schemes and a process to detect changes to withdrawal limits on accounts, right? So these are controls associated with like policy changes. So a system of controls that detects and reports on things that are out of standard. That is incredibly highly important when you're talking about banking or anything where you have sophisticated systems like that that are very attractive targets. All right. And one other thing that was really interesting here was that it took them quite a while to find this guy. And so that suggests that they just didn't have good audit controls overall from the very beginning. But, you know, they learned their lesson and they moved on. All right, the next piece of this is about configuration exploitation. And I find this interesting because this story of the misconfiguration, it never goes away. For probably the last 5 years in a row, Gartner's reports have suggested that something in excess of 97% of breaches are occurring due to some misconfiguration. And so what that means from their perspective is that these issues were preventable if the systems that were already existing in place had been configured properly. So what that means from a business perspective is the company had already spent the money, right? They already had a system in place that was capable of mitigating that threat, but had not gotten it configured properly. Therefore, they spent money and had an ineffective outcome. So given the fact that this is, I have to say, it's absolutely bar none, the number one thing that I see is misconfiguration. And there is tons and tons and tons of it out there. Misconfiguration seems to be ubiquitous in nature. And there's a lot of that that comes down to a lot of people are configuring things that they're not qualified to configure. And then in some cases, companies will hire a specialist to implement a system, but they don't do good training and standards documentation with the on-site IT staff so that those systems then aren't maintained. And maybe that relationship with the original implementer is not maintained, so then there's not a system for ongoing maintenance and improvement. You have to have all of those parts and pieces in place. And what Verizon was finding was that a tremendous number of, they said 80%, in fact, of data breaches involve the exploitation of stolen, weak, default, or easily guessable passwords. So passwords seem to be a big area of breach, yet it's so easy to fix. Use complex passwords. Use multi-factor authentication passwords. Change the passwords. Something else I have to mention that they don't even have listed in here is that every single time you change a password on a Windows device, the old password cached credentials, wherever they happen to be, are now invalidated. So you are defeating Mimikatz and pass the hash attacks if that password on that account is changed, which is why it's so super important that those passwords are changed regularly. And again, I stress multi-factor authentication as well. So again, 80% of data breaches involve the exploitation of stolen, weak, default, or easily guessable passwords. And so I can also say that I do get frustrated with some folks who say to me that their stuff is not important enough to where they need to use a complex password. And my response to that is always, do you care about your reputation? Right? Do you want somebody to be using your identity? Because if they've breached your email account, then they're now emailing other people as if they're you. So they're now using your identity. And in that, what havoc are they doing? What inappropriate emails are they sending? What services are they signing up for and using your email address, tying it to that and claiming that this is now part of your identity? So, you know, this is like, it's like identity theft. So I suppose if you don't care whether or not your identity is stolen, then sure, use weak passwords. But otherwise, you should be serious about passwords, because if we know that 80% of breaches can be mitigated by using good password management practices and using multi-factor authentication, boy, that sure seems to be some low-hanging, easy-to-obtain, and easy-to-access fruit. So good password practices are absolutely a no-brainer. And I'm just still highly entertained by that. Well, I think that's it for today's show. I'm going to have to move on to part three of this, because there's so much good to be learned here from this. But just in summary, we're not really learning anything new. What we are learning so far, and what we'll continue to learn throughout the rest of this adventure, is that the techniques that we know how to utilize in order to mitigate the threats, they still work. You just have to implement them.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com.